From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, General Motors works toward a fully electric fleet.
It is a major, major move, and it indicates the direction that at least one company thinks this industry is headed.
And a National Guard specialist talks to us about the reversal in policy on transgender people serving in the military.
When I read the news, I was so overwhelmed. I started bawling. I felt like for the first time in a long time that I was actually seen.
Then a conversation about the disproportionate losses women have suffered in the workforce during the pandemic.
In January 2020, I said, I cannot imagine what would dislodge women from this point of ascendancy that they're currently at. And the reason was I couldn't imagine a global pandemic.
Those stories just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're continuing a conversation about women in the workforce hit hardest by the pandemic.
So when they get that new job doesn't often come at the same sort of pay rate that they had when they left.
That's in the second half of the show, but first, anyone who's even casually picked up an automotive magazine lately knows that the world's vehicle makers are restructuring to prepare for more electric and hybrid models. GM affirmed its place in the game this week, announcing it will aspire to sell only electric vehicles by 2040. Now, you notice that word, aspire. Leaves a lot of wiggle room, doesn't it? And yet, it's not nothing coming from the biggest U.S. automaker. We've invited a couple of friends to talk about this and related developments. Aaron Marquis is the managing editor for Jalopnik, and Daniel House is a senior editor and columnist for the Detroit News.
Both of you, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be here.
So, Dan, what's in it for GM to be the first major U.S. automaker to make a pledge like this?
Well, initially, I think you've got to say the communications aspect in a new administration is about as good as you can get. And I think that is driving a little bit of the skepticism about why now. I mean, this is a company that just a few weeks ago was part of a Trump administration lawsuit challenging California's right to set its own emission standards. They dropped that, got out of that lawsuit, angered rival automakers who were also on the same side of the argument as they were. And then within a few weeks, they take this pledge. It looks a little opportunistic. All that being said, it is a major, major move, and it indicates the direction that at least one company thinks this industry is headed. And I think they're responding to not only a new administration in Washington, but regulatory moves in key markets like China and the European Union.
Still, it's not as if General Motors thought this up last night. Aaron, do you see any dissonance between the announcement and the way GM's been talking for the past 4 years?
I actually think Mary Barra made a lot of smart moves under Trump. There was never keeping him completely happy, but she angled GM to really start working on an EV future while keeping up a communications position that they were really staying on the side of the current administration. So it's not that big of a surprise. GM has been talking about significant electrification since 2019, really. And yeah, major markets are, I'm looking at a list of over 31 countries and states right now who have made a pledge to ban ICE vehicles by 2040. It's actually kind of surprising to me that GM is the one to make this move. Toyota and Nissan, both of whom are on that side of suing the federal government for the CARB standards, they started off the electrification revolution, and they've fallen so far behind that now Nissan is saying they don't expect significant electrification until 2040 or 2050. So GM is a huge company. They usually make slow changes. They usually have to like really be harangued into it. So for them to be looking forward like this, this is not something that came out of the blue. And it's really kind of an impressive move for the company.
I agree with that. I don't think it is something that necessarily came out of the blue. I think it was, to your point, a part of an iteration. But the GM that you describe, I think accurately, is not the GM of today. One of the analysts that we quoted in our story this morning says GM is going to where the puck is going to be, not where the puck is. And I think that's, you know, obviously a hockey metaphor, but I think it's apt here. They are making a big move here. They are using words like aspire, pledge. There's no guarantee that they're not going to be selling ICEs after 2035. at least at now. One of the things that's important here is the positioning of the company. If you go back and look at the performance of General Motors stock since it emerged from bankruptcy and did its IPO, it traded in a very narrow range in the mid-30s for a very, very, very long time. And it's only been in the last probably 6 months, it's actually only been in the last few weeks, that it broke $50 a share. And I think that's in part because in the investment community, which is very enamored of electric vehicles, particularly because of Tesla, is looking to see, are these companies, are these legacy manufacturers for real? Can they really do this? Can they really pivot to electrification? And I think the story for GM is increasingly the answer is yes, that the investment community does believe that they can do this. Now, the path is not so easy, and we can talk about kind of the pitfalls that lay ahead. But I do think that this is for real, and it is part of a broader strategy.
Aaron, part of this announcement was GM saying that there will be $27 billion spent on the electric transition, they think, within the next 5 years. Do you have an inkling of how much of that money gets spent in Michigan?
I hope plenty, as somebody from Michigan and who lives here. But who can really say where they're going to park that money? They say often that they're very, you know, they're very devoted to keeping jobs in America and in Michigan. But it is really hard to say. Right now, GM sells, you know, 2.5 million vehicles last year, and only 20,000 of them were EVs. So it's kind of an open question.
I would say a fair amount. I mean, Detroit Hamtramck plant is being totally retooled into, you know, what are they calling it? Factory Zero, which is going to be essentially the only real pure electric plant they have. Lake Orion is already building the Bolt. And then you have a Canadian plant that just been designated. The CAMI plant has been designated as a EV plant, a partial EV plant. But over time, they expect the mix to change in a place like Spring Hill, which is huge, and that they will be building more EVs and fewer ICEs. But a lot of the intellectual work that's done on this is all done right here in metropolitan Detroit, in the Warren Tech Center and affiliated areas. I think Michigan is probably pretty well positioned. At one point, I was curious as to whether or not GM was going to essentially designate Michigan as its EV, you know, center. They've decided, obviously, not to do that. They're spreading their bets in terms of production. Mm-hmm. But I would say we're probably pretty well positioned for it.
I remember when hybrid engines first started becoming a thing. I had a lot of trouble sort of figuring myself out as a consumer, you know, what my piece of this was. And oh my God, am I still going to be able to fill up my Saturn? That feels like that ages me as the dinosaur that I am. But I do wonder if you do have thoughts on just, I mean, there are markets and then there are markets. When we think about, you know, the average consumer who's maybe driving, internal combustion engine SUV right now, how long before the offerings that GM and the other automakers are doing are talking about, how long before those become more of what we come to think of as normal?
I was just talking about this with my team because Genesis is announcing some electric vehicles today, and they're always naming these electric vehicles with an E at the end or a plus. And my thinking is, these are normal cars, name them like normal cars, so consumers feel like they're buying normal cars. I think it's going to take like a major culture shift. Americans are also, we still have that range anxiety, which is a little ridiculous. And I think we're seeing more and more often, especially now that we're all in COVID lockdown, how little we're actually driving.
Yeah.
And you're also seeing superchargers and batteries that are capable of charging just as fast as a car is capable of fueling up. They're not here yet, but they're on the horizon. So I think once you, the best way to cure America's range anxiety is to get that charging infrastructure faster and more complete. That's going to take a lot of investment from both the automakers and from the federal government. I could see EVs becoming, you know, more accepted, you know, maybe in like 10 years. It's hard to say, really. It's going to take a major culture shift, though.
Yeah.
I think it depends. You know, it's that classic case. It depends. I mean, are we talking about pure electrics that have to be charged, or are we talking about hybrid gas electric hybrids? Ford Motor Company puts a lot betting that there's going to be a suite of technologies. It's going to include the internal combustion engine. It's going to include gas electric hybrids. It's going to include pure electrics. And I was editing the review of our critic, Henry Payne, on the hybrid F-150. And Henry's, anybody reads his stuff knows he's a real motorhead, but he understands the industry. And what he says about that vehicle, the hybrid F-150, is that it's a remarkable product. I mean, you get it not only with a gas engine, so you don't have the range anxieties, but you have an onboard generator and you have all sorts of other things that you don't have in a normal pickup truck. So there's some, I think we're going to go through a period here where different companies are going to try different things and we're going to see how they take off. I mean, Tesla has been phenomenal, but it's a very much a premium product. And, you know, we're going to see here as major manufacturers come online with a lot of their different EV offerings, just how broad the market is. We know that there is a high-end market for these vehicles, but how broad is the market? And I don't think we know that yet.
Daniel Howes is a senior editor and columnist at the Detroit News, and we've also been talking with Aaron Marquis, managing editor at Jalopnik. Aaron, Dan, very nice to talk to you.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks very much.
We talked to one Michigan mechanic about what electrification has meant for the technicians in his shop. You want to hear the conversation? It's on today's Stateside podcast. You can pick it up wherever you listen to podcasts. While you're there, please be sure to rate us and leave us a review. It's a great way to help other people find what we're doing. Coming up, a Michigan National Guard specialist talks about President Biden's reversal of the ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military.
The Army's famous slogan is hurry up and wait, but there's thousands of trans people that are in that have waited long enough.
That's after a break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, President Joe Biden reversed the federal transgender military ban. It's another sea change in the lives of Michiganders who've spent lifetimes reading Shifting Terrain. Blair McIntyre is a Michigan Army National Guard specialist who fought against the ban in federal court. Blair previously served in active duty combat in Afghanistan, and she's a trans woman. Despite her years of service, she was threatened with discharge under the ban. She joins us now to talk about why she decided to step up and challenge the rules and what happens now. Blair McIntyre, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What was your reaction when you first heard that President Biden was making this decision to reverse the ban for transgender folks who were serving?
You know, we heard back in November, you know, that was something that he wanted to do, but you know, you don't want to get too excited. And, you know, I wasn't trying to get naive with it. But when it finally happened, I was actually at work. My phone started going crazy with countless texts and emails. And when I read the news, I was so overwhelmed. I started bawling. I felt like for the first time in a long time that I was actually seen and I was actually noticed. And not just me, but my entire community, the entire LGBTQ community.
It's been a long road. Can you tell us a little bit about your path into the military and what drew you to service?
Sure. I always kind of had tendencies of dysphoria. I just didn't really understand fully at the time what it was. And I felt that going into the military would help me find my place in the world and help me find an identity. And I joined and I did active duty. I got out and I missed it and I came back into the Michigan National Guard. Being in uniform, again, gave me that sense of identity. And then, of course, in 2019, it was almost like an alarm clock went off that I needed to transition. I needed to accept who I was inside. And I came out as a trans woman.
When you first entered the military, was there a part of you that maybe in some way felt or just intuited that there would be this piece of yourself, a big piece that you'd have to keep hidden?
You know, and it's funny, looking back in hindsight, it's definite now, but at the time it wasn't. It wasn't always a definite thing. You know, when I was a kid and when I was in high school, I knew who I was inside. But, you know, as I became an adult and got married and, you know, started my life as an adult, I didn't, it's not that the feelings went away. I just was distracted by other things. So joining, I was at the time really focused on my new role, my new duty. You know, I had a new career and I was very excited at the time.
Blair, you actually challenged the federal ban on transgender service members that was implemented under President Trump. Can you tell us what's going to happen to that lawsuit now that President Biden has reversed the ban?
So the lawsuit's now dropped in the process of, and, you know, it feels good to not have that added stress over my head. Again, it's very rewarding to see that we're, you know, once again, we are looked at and we're seen and we're visible, and it's very meaningful to us to be recognized as people. So anytime you ban a group of people or you keep a group of people out, you know, in a sense, it feels like it dehumanizes you. And like I said, from all my friends that are transgender in service, it seems like it's pretty across the board. We're all feeling that there's a light on us again, that we're noticed.
So Blair, the reversal of the ban, does that mean that you're able to fully identify as a woman when you're on the job?
Currently, as everything stands, no. I still am forced to go to work presenting male. There has been no guidance yet put down from the new policy as to what that entails. So this entire fight, I've been forced to go into work presenting as a male, even though I'm legally a woman. I'm medically a woman. I still have to go into work presenting male.
Does that detract at all from a feeling of relief and a feeling of victory in seeing the policy formally overturned?
It does. And at the same time, it also, you know, we sit here from, you know, at this point and we're going, I hope that it becomes easier. You know, it's, The Army's famous slogan is hurry up and wait, but there's thousands of trans people that are in that have waited long enough. And I really hope that the new policy, whatever the details are for that, that it allows trans people to have an easier transition from, you know, their birth gender to their gender that they identify with.
Do we know for sure that those policies are on the way now that Joe Biden has sort of said, yes, it's going to be okay for trans people to serve?
I mean, we do know that, you know, something has to be done. You know, I don't know the details on who is doing what for the policy, but just knowing that it has to happen. So I hope that they make a new policy, because the one in 2016, when the ban was not a thing yet, it still was difficult for trans people to change their gender marker. It was very difficult for them across all branches. So I'm optimistic, and I hope that in the future that this new policy makes it easier for us.
Do you mind telling us a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. I work at Camp Grayling, and I work range control there. I'm also a weapons specialist in small arms. I've done that since active duty until today. It's pretty rewarding. It's fun. Definitely not the same day every day.
I think in the Michigan Guard that men and women do train together. Isn't that right?
Correct.
Are there other intersections or places on the job where the presentation, you know, what you're forced into in terms of presentation gets awkward?
It does. And, you know, when I go to places where people don't know me, they don't see a male. Everyone addresses me as she and her. So it's for the people that I work with that decided not to address me as such, it kind of makes it awkward when they still say he, him. And now it forces me to explain what's going on, you know, and talk about, you know, what, why they're calling me a he versus a she. So that's like the points where it becomes awkward. You know, I'm legally a woman. I present female every day, every time I'm not in uniform. So I sit there and worry sometimes for little things that people wouldn't think about, like my driver's license. You know, what if I get pulled over in uniform? My driver's license shows a completely different person.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Specialist Blair McIntyre of the Michigan Army National Guard. She initiated a lawsuit against the ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military. She's since dropped that lawsuit now that President Biden has reversed the ban. Coming out to family and friends is difficult enough under the best of circumstances. For some people, it is liberating. But what was it like to come out in the workplace?
It was scary. You know, the military has always had that masculine undertone, and I was definitely afraid. But when I came out, you know, of course there were moments where it was difficult, but for the most part, most people were very accepting. More importantly, the people I worked with directly, they were very supporting of me. And, you know, they've all been rooting me along and cheering me along. And, you know, just like when we were talking earlier, when the ban was lifted, a lot of those calls were from people I worked with. They're very supportive. So in reality, I had a reality check that it's not always bad. And I'm actually very happy with the majority of my support that I've got.
When you were having difficult times, either, you know, grappling with what the ban was saying about trans people in service, or just, you know, just having a hard time with things you were dealing with personally, what were the things that got you through the tough days?
Honestly, it's that, you know, looking at so many people that have been fighting before me, even, you know, there's been so many trans people and cis people that have been fighting for us since the ban happens. And, you know, when times got hard for me, I thought, you know, there's people that have had hard times for 20 years on this, if not more. And so I looked for inspiration back in history and, you know, seeing the examples that I had, and it kept me going. It kept me positive.
You know, you mentioned that you do have some community within military service members who are also trans. What were some of the ways that you found your community?
Sure. The biggest one, of course, is social media. You know, there's a misconception that there's not a lot of us in service, but there is a lot of us. There's a lot of different figures. I've heard as high of 14,000. And we all found, you know, a place online, different various sites like Instagram, Facebook, et cetera. And that's where we networked and, you know, we all met each other. And that's where I met majority of my friends. And I actually have met a couple in the Michigan Guard that have come up to me and humbly have thanked me for what I'm doing. And that really, really brought a tear to my eye.
Were there ways in which you think the experience of, I don't know about going into service, but the experience of going overseas and serving in combat, were there ways in which you think that affected or accelerated your decision to come out?
No, I don't. I think, you know, whenever a soldier comes back from a deployment, you're faced with challenges, you know, family, your everyday life, you know, it's hard. It's hard on everyone that does that and goes through that. But I don't think that, especially at that time, I was honestly just happy to be home, as most of us were. So I would say it did give me a bit of a backbone to definitely overcome fear easier. And that really helped a lot. I would say if anything, it helped me rather than discouraged me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because of the community and the support that you had?
Right. And, you know, the hard life lessons, you know, that especially in deployment, we take for granted, you know, living our lives and, you know, how precious it is. And when you're in an environment like that, you really learn to live life to the fullest every day. And, you know, when the time came, as I said earlier, the alarm went off that I needed to transition, that hard lesson came back that I need to live every day authentically and as myself.
For sure. For sure. I wonder how some of the cisgendered folks that you serve with have reacted to the news that President Biden has overturned the ban.
Yeah, a lot. You know, again, I think there's a big misconception that, you know, cisgendered people are against transgender people. And that's not what I've been seeing. I've actually been congratulated quite a bit. Again, my phone was blowing up and those were not all trans people. Actually, most of them were cisgendered people. They were excited, you know, from especially leadership, they've been really excited because now they're able to have a bigger candidacy pool. You know, trans people, just like all people, are talented, unique, can bring something to the table. And so I really have seen a lot of support for us.
You know, the military is not always an easy place to be a pioneer. But it's also one of those places in American society where white cisgender guys have learned normalcy about working alongside women, working alongside people of color, working alongside queer people. I mean, it's a place where anybody who goes into service is going to get thrown in with tons of other people whose life experience is just different than theirs. To that point about recruiting, I mean, if a younger person came to you and asked, you know, what should I keep in mind if I'm thinking about joining? Can you envision a chapter for the American military that is truly normalized for trans people and non-binary people?
Sure. I really see, you know, again, with this ban being lifted, I see that that's the direction it's going to be going. You know, there's new policies coming out very soon. I just read recently that, you know, men are now able to wear clear nail polish in service. And there's different things that are starting to come in that are more welcoming to the queer community. And I really do see that down the road, it's going to just be, like you said, normal. And it's already getting there. It really is. And it's important. It's why I preach education so much. You know, unfortunately, it is a burden of ours that sometimes we have to do more than others, but it's, you know, I always take the opportunity if someone asks me questions to have that conversation with them, because that's what's going to bring normalcy to our community and the military community to have, you know, a nice equality between the two.
It is not easy to get policy changes like the one that we've just seen. Witness your lawsuit. Do you think it will be harder to change, you know, people's habits, people's ways of thinking on an everyday level, all the little ephemeral things that still have an effect on how you move through your days?
I think that the difficulty is that we're not able to go to work in our genders and presenting as who we are. I think that's what makes it difficult. But I do see that if policy changes, it becomes easy. And, you know, I can go to work as presenting female, as the woman that I am. And for, you know, men also, I think that would help alleviate a lot of that problem. I think by forcing us to go in, like in my case, forcing me to adhere to male standards going into work, I think that's where a lot of that misgendering can and sometimes does happen. So I hope that the new policy addresses this and takes in consideration, you know, transgender people, that this is something that is important to us. Trans people are not looking for special treatment. And I hear that all the time, that, you know, people think that that's what we're after, and we're not. We want equality, and we want what everyone else is. As cliche as it sounds, this uniform represents that freedom and that idea and that principle, which is outlined in the Constitution. And I just really want people to know that we're just after equality.
Well, Blair McIntyre, thank you for your service, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Honor's mine.
After years of gaining ground, the pandemic has pulled the rug out from under women in Michigan's workforce.
Once you've lost work and you have to go out and find a new job, you're starting almost back from square one. And that means that you erase years of progress that you've made in terms of, you know, promotions and raises.
Up next, the unequal impact of COVID job loss. Stick with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. COVID has exacerbated so many of the problems that plague us, or at least made them visible in ways that we can't deny. From an economic standpoint, Michigan's businesses are closing and downsizing. And as those jobs disappear, access to basic human needs begins to dwindle. Almost everyone's affected by the pandemic's hit to our economy. But society's most vulnerable are the ones who feel it the most. And when it comes to job loss, it's women of color seeing this firsthand. What happens when they leave the job market? In the last few days, we've spoken to a few women about their experiences juggling work and family, or managing a business while holding public office, rearranging their lives because schools have closed. With us to interpret the bigger picture of women leaving the workforce is Betsy Stevenson, labor economist and professor at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy. Betsy, welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to talk with you.
Let's talk about some of the ways in which this is hitting the women who have lost out. Some studies have told us that in the 5 or so years leading up to 2020, last year, that the historic and very stubborn pay gaps between men and women continued to decrease. That was certainly something we heard from one of the workers that we talked to. Let's listen to Claudette Pointer. She lives in Southeast Michigan, and she was laid off from her job last year as the manager at a staffing agency.
I did come into the company at, I think I was at 1075. And then, you know, gradually my pay rate started inclining. And so by the time I get to the $21 an hour, you know, life started looking so grand for me. You know, I was able to pay, you know, my bills pretty much out of one check. And so it was, I began to start living a more of a comfortable life. And then all of a sudden COVID hit. And I think I had only received, I was only at $21 for a good month and a half. And then of course my company laid a lot of the managers, pretty much all the managers. Then I had to seek unemployment. And that was like a big slap in the face, because I'm like, right while I'm getting started to like become comfortable, life took a shift.
So Betsy Stevenson, is what Claudette Pointer's describing, is that consistent with what you're seeing happening to women in the workforce?
Oh, that clip is so heartbreaking, and it does really is a great example of what's going to happen to so many women. So what happens when people lose their job is, of course, they lose their current income, but they also tend to fall behind. So when they get that new job doesn't often happen at come at the same sort of pay rate that they had when they left, right? So Claudette just described this beautiful story of working her way up from just over $10 an hour to $21 an hour. And that real progress in her life, it was allowing her to live better. And now she's lost her job, and she describes being on unemployment. But the next part of this story is equally distressing, which is that she's not very likely to get hired back at $21 an hour. You know, she may end up finding a job, if she's lucky, at $15 or $16 an hour. So her story, her journey of loss isn't even over yet. And I think that that is what happens for so many people who lose work. And she just really illustrates it so vividly, because once you've lost work and you have to go out and find a new job, you're starting almost back from square one. And that means that you erase years of progress that you've made in terms of, you know, promotions and raises. And when I tell this story, when we talk about this, people so often focus on, you know, the highly educated woman who's in a profession where, you know, she has to maybe take time out of the labor force because of her kids, and then she comes back and she doesn't get the promotions. But you're usually, people think, I think, naturally about people at the higher end of the income distribution when they think about that loss of wage gains that come from missing out on promotions. But that applies throughout the income distribution. And I think the story you just heard is the one I've been trying to focus on, because it means that it is why COVID has not only created greater inequality in the United States, but that inequality, that increase in inequality created by COVID, is not going to go away when COVID does.
Betsy, do we know what was starting, what factors contributed to start to close that wage gap between men and women before 2020?
Well, what we've seen is a couple of things that have all been leading to closing the gender wage gap. So women have been getting more education than men along every dimension. They're more likely to go to community college. They're more likely to graduate with a college degree. They're more likely to go on and get an advanced degree. They're also doing better in college, so their grades are higher. So they're getting that sort of formal training, formal education, pursuing goals like that. And then they are working more, so they're more likely to have spent time with the same employer. When you spend time with the same employer, you tend to get raises. So that we think about that as their sort of work experience and tenure, their tenure with the same employer has been increasing, so that it's now equal to that of men, roughly. And you heard that story with Claudette, where she stayed with the same employer and she got raise after raise after raise. And at the end, she was earning twice what she'd been earning at the beginning. So it's sticking with the same employer. It's pursuing promotions. It's getting more education and training. All of those things had contributed to narrowing the gender wage gap, as well as, you know, efforts for women to enter professions that have not been traditionally thought of as female, that tend to pay more. We've seen, you know, obviously progress for women in STEM and science. But I think the stat that I really focus on is in December 2019, women held the majority of jobs in the country. They weren't more likely than men to be employed. But if you're talking about jobs where you have an employer, you bring home a paycheck, women held most of them.
Just in terms of raw numbers.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say most of them. Women held the majority of them. So they held more of them than men did. So they ticked over 50%. But it was a really important moment, because the reason they held more jobs in December 2019 than men was because what we saw in the recovery and the economic growth between, say, 2015 and 2020 was a rise in female labor force participation, more women working. In 2019, we saw the highest share of women with young kids working that we'd ever seen in the United States before. So women with a kid under six were more likely to be at work in 2019 than they had been at any other year in our past. So we saw this just increase in female participation in employment. And of course, that also contributes to them earning higher wages. And that persisted in January of 2020 and February of 2020. And in fact, I did an interview with NPR in January 2020, which I sometimes reflect back on because I said, I cannot imagine what would dislodge women from this point of ascendancy that they're currently at. I couldn't imagine it. And the reason was I couldn't imagine a global pandemic. All right. That I couldn't imagine we would have a global pandemic that would mean that would target in-person jobs. And I think that it really highlights where was women's, you know, how has the economy been changing and how has that impacted women? Since the beginning of the 2008 recession, so go all the way back to the end of 2007, when we, in February of 2020, we still had a million fewer jobs in that goods producing sector. And we had added 15 million jobs in the service sector. So what's been growing over that all that time period are jobs in education and health services and business and professional services. These are jobs that women hold. Women got the majority of those additional 15 million jobs that we added. But the problem was this recession targeted those jobs that women got through the growth. And that is what has dislodged them from their position as the majority of job holders.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Betsy Stevenson. She's a labor economist and professor at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. I want to go back to Claudette Poynter, who we just heard from a moment ago. She told Stateside that she did ultimately apply for public assistance last year to make up for lost wages. But this was, I think, not what a lot of people expect when they think about tapping unemployment benefits. So let's hear how she describes it.
I made enough money to where I didn't have to use those particular services. I don't have anything against them. So here, dealing with COVID now, none of that clicked in my head to go sign up for any of that until one of my girlfriends, she did reach out to me and she said, are you receiving food stamps? Because I was calling and asking for someone to help me get food at the time. And then one of my girlfriends asked me, she said, are you receiving food stamps? I said, no, I never even thought to do it. She said, well, they're giving out extra because of COVID. So I right away, I jumped on there and I and this is all just recently because I just got my full food stamp benefit on last week. So I've gone through this entire pandemic with very little.
Again, that's Claudette Poynter of Southeast Michigan, one of the millions of people in Michigan who lost work due to the COVID pandemic and one of a great many women in that situation. Betsy Stevenson, like we heard, Claudette was fortunate to get some help from SNAP benefits. The things that the government has done to this point to help, do you see them as having a measurable impact on people's quality of life, according to the indicators that economists would think about?
Well, I mean, yes. So the government has reacted quite swiftly. And it, in fact, if I look at, you know, what was in the CARES Act and what they did in March, it was an incredibly impressive, quick reaction to the situation we were in, and expanding unemployment insurance to cover so many people, giving those additional payments to make up for the fact that unemployment insurance usually pays such a small fraction of people's income, usually makes up for such a small fraction of people's income. Those additional payments were necessary to try to ensure that people who had lost their work could pay their rent and put food on the table. And then increased things like food stamps, work to make sure that there were benefits available for kids who usually got benefits through, say, school lunch programs. So there was a lot of action taken. I think the real problem was then the government sort of ran out of steam, or you might think became more focused on partisan arguing on the Hill and less focused on getting something passed. And as a result, I think we didn't have enough benefits going into the fall. And, there was action taken towards the end of the year. We've got the President Biden working right now with Democrats to get additional relief passed. We're not done with COVID. We're not done with the pain of it. And we do need to be supporting families right now. And I, you know, if you listen to Claudette, one of the things you realize is all the hand-wringing that happens in Washington, D.C. about how people will exploit benefits if we give them too much or we can't afford this. It's just wrong. People don't want to be on benefits if they don't have to be. What they want is to be able to eat and put food on the table. And this recession, like no other that I've ever seen, has disproportionately hit people at the bottom of the income distribution, while people at the top of the income distribution have had very little pain in terms of loss of income. And they don't have as many things to spend their money on because they can't travel, they can't go on vacation, and the restaurants are shut. So what we see is literally a savings glut at the top of the income distribution, people just hanging on to income that they don't know what to do with, while folks in the bottom half of the income distribution are out of savings. They've tapped into everything they have. And we really need to see more government support for folks that are out of savings, that have really been struggling all year. And it's got to be a concentrated effort to combat the increase in inequality that's been caused by COVID.
What happens in society when women are less present in the workforce?
I find that a kind of hard question to answer because, first of all, I'm an optimist, and I think women are going back. I think that they're going to become the majority of job holders again. I don't think that COVID will permanently change the trajectory. And I've emphasized how we're seeing growth in the service sector in the United States. That's the basis of our economy. You always have these politicians that are emphasizing, how are we going to get manufacturing jobs back? The reality is that's rounding error on our job growth. It's just a small fraction of the economy. It's much smaller. All of the goods producing sector, there are fewer employees than there are in office and administrative support in the United States.
Wow.
So our economy, right? Like, you got to put this in perspective. Our economy is a service-based economy. That means accounting services. That means entertainment services. Service is really broad. It's much bigger than what people's, mental image of somebody bringing you a cup of coffee or a meal. But women dominate that whole sector. And I don't think you can continue to have job growth. I don't think the U.S. economy can continue to expand without bringing women back. So women will come back. I think the big question is what happens to the individual women who've really been hurt by COVID. How do we make it so that we can get Claudette back to $21 an hour? I think that's where we really have to be focused, because otherwise, you could go back and interview Claudette in 3 or 4 years and find out that she hasn't still fully recovered from COVID. And that's a real tragedy. And I think we shouldn't give up as in terms of public policy until we've made sure that someone like Claudette is not only back at work, but back at work really with the same kind of footing, the same kind of work responsibilities, the same kind of productivity, and the same kind of earnings.
Betsy Stevenson is a labor economist and professor at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Betsy, thank you so much.
It was such a great pleasure talking with you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovid, and Olive Scott. The executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Our show is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.